Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This will be part two of a two-parter that we're doing on Isaac through Jacob and the tales of their lives and some of their main doings that go on in the book of Genesis. We're back with the Genesis team. We had done a previous call before, and we're releasing that as part one, and we're back now for part two. Well, David, where we left off last time was with basically Rebecca bemoaning that Esau had taken a son among the Hittites, and it seems like that it was the desire of her heart that Jacob, her favored son, does not do the same thing. So Rebecca is encouraging her to go to her brother's house, her brother Laban's house, and to find somebody in his household for Jacob to marry. So that's at the end of 27. So either pick up there or start it with 28, if you would, David.
Good. So yeah, that beautiful verse in the King James Version of the Bible at the end of 27, verse 46, reads, "And Rebecca said to Isaac, 'I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob take a wife of these daughters of Heth, such as these which are of the daughter, wife of the daughters of Heth, such as these which are the daughters of the land, what good shall my life do me?'" Again, an emphasis on the desire to keep the bloodlines pure and to distinguish Israelite ancestry from the indigenous population of Canaan. That helps us prepare then for 28, Dan, which is such a wonderful chapter, especially I think interesting for Latter-day Saints because of all of the temple imagery. Jacob travels and heads then out of the land of Canaan, and he's going to journey to, as you mentioned, Rebekah's brother, Laban, and visit his house and ultimately fall in love with Rachel. So in chapter 28, he travels to, we'll pick it up then in verse 10, "Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran." And then verse 11 is beautiful. Watch the emphasis on the word place. "And he," meaning Jacob, "lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows, and lay down in that place to sleep." So over and over again, the author is going to use the theme word makom in Hebrew, meaning place, because of its cultic significance. The term makom is frequently linked with temple worship all throughout the Hebrew Bible. So for example, the famous Psalm 24, "Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? Who shall stand in his holy place?" Or even Exodus chapter 3, where Moses ascends a mountain and enters the presence of God, which is the purpose of a temple in the ancient world. He's told to take his shoes off, for the place where he stands is holy ground. And because it carries this temple imagery or cultic significance, the author of this account seems to play with it as a theme word. Scholars use the term Leitwort from the German leading word or theme word to signify what's going on here. So as we jump forward in the account, for example, that theme word place is going to appear all over. Verse 16, "Jacob awaked out of his sleep." We'll go back and we'll hit the latter theme. But he awakes out of his sleep. He said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." He was afraid and said, "How dreadful is this place? This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." Notice the temple house of God imagery. The gate of heaven, gates were signified not only in ancient Israel, but gates signified in ancient Babylonian culture as well, the concept of temple worship. Even the word Babylon in Akkadian, the language of ancient Babylon and Assyria, is Bab-Elim, from the Akkadian word Bab, meaning gate, and Elim, meaning God. So Babylon, literally in the language of its origin, means the gate of God. It's because they believed that their temple, their city, was the place where you could pass through a gate and enter into the presence of the divine world. So again, emphasis on place in verse 19, he called the name place, see it's over and over again, Beth-El, which the LDS footnote tells us correctly means the house of God.
Awesome.
It's interesting that the latter would take on a significance later on in Isaiah's writings and in the Johannine corpus of the New Testament to be a way to find wisdom, as you would use the temple imagery to approach God, who had ultimate wisdom. So your ultimate wisdom teachers would climb the ladder of and ascend upward into where true wisdom existed.
I love the connection then with temple worship and the wisdom concept. The temple imagery that runs all throughout this chapter is especially exciting for a Latter-day Saint audience. When I share this chapter in a Sunday school or institute setting, I like to draw attention to the connections between Genesis 28 and the old Protestant hymn, Near My God to Thee. Verse 2 specifically, though like the wanderer, the sun gone down, darkness be over me, my rest a stone. Well, the wanderer in that line is, of course, Jacob, who is wandering at this point and literally does use a stone for his pillow. Yet in my dreams I'd be near my God to thee. Well, an allusion to Jacob's dream that he has where he sees the staircase, or as it's translated in the King James Version of the Bible, the ladder connecting heaven and earth. Verse 3, there let the way appear, steps unto heaven, all that thou sendest me in mercy given. And then that beautiful line 4 that is never sung in LDS congregations, but still is there on the page. Then with my waking thoughts, bright with my praise, out of my stony griefs, Beth-El, meaning house of God, all raise. So by my woes to be near my God to thee. So literally, of course, that is the purpose of a temple, whether ancient or modern, is to provide a sacred location that can help us draw near to God. And this is just an exciting connection I think our audience might enjoy.
Yeah, and then yet King James called it the ladder instead of the staircase. And, you know, I know that Spicer and whatnot in the Anchor Bible says that it's probably more a temple, more a ziggurat.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah.
Some even say ramp, which doesn't make as much sense as a staircase.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the Hebrew word is sulam, and it seems to be, I believe, a cognate with the Akkadian word similtu, which it refers to a ziggurat. So literally a staircase, a steeped temple. All of this then reminds us of other Mesopotamian imagery that we'll see. For example, there's a clear counterpart to the image of God's angels ascending and descending found in an old Babylonian myth known as Nergal and Ereshkigal. And in that tradition, we see gods literally from the council using the staircase that connects the heavens with the netherworld.
Right.
So this does seem to be ancient Mesopotamian imagery, which, as we've discussed in previous podcasts, ancient Mesopotamia has a tremendous influence on these sources in Genesis.
Awesome. Anything more in this chapter of 28? We've got him seeing the vision. He blesses it. He names it Beth-El. Anything else?
I've got some Midrash stuff, if you're interested.
Please.
Midrash interpreters were confused on a couple of points with this this latter thing. First of all, they wondered why it needed to be a dream. Why couldn't God simply just speak to Jacob like he had to Abraham? So that was one question they had. Another question they wondered about was, why was Jacob afraid? You know, why was he fearful of this place? And what would be so frightening about a ladder with angels on it? And so they pondered that, and they came up with a couple of different conclusions to that. They looked at this whole ladder scene as a symbolic message about the future, either Jacob's own future or that of his descendants. And if you look at some of the Midrash, particularly, let's say, Leviticus Rabbah, for instance, they write about these angels, were they not instead the guardian angels of the nations of the world that would rule Israel in the future? He, God, showed him, Jacob, meaning Jacob, Babylon's angel climbing up 70 rungs and going down. Then he showed him Media's, meaning Persians, angel going up and down 52, and then Greece's going up and down 180, then Rome's went up and up, and he, Jacob, did not know how many rungs it would ascend. Jacob took fright at this and said, "O Lord, do you mean that this one has no descent?" God said to him, "Even if you see him reach the very heavens, I will still cause him to go down, as it is written." And then he does a, but you can see what they're doing there. They're looking at the future of Israel under these guardian nations,
right,
as these represent. And so that's kind of an interesting interpretation. The second way they kind of addressed these questions that they had was that these angels were very interested in seeing Jacob as he slept. And so the idea is that these band of angels descend to earth on this great ladder in order to get a glimpse of this extraordinary individual and then go back up into heaven. So Targum Neophides says, "And he, Jacob, dreamt, and the angels who had accompanied him from his father's house went up to announce to the angels on high," and here's the quote, "Come and see the righteous man Jacob, whose likeness is set upon the divine throne, the one whom you have wanted to see," unquote. "Then the holy angels of God went up and down to gaze upon him."
Wow. So even before his big wrestle, when he finally seems to turn a corner and become a good guy, they still want to make him like practically perfect already.
Practically perfect in every way.
Yeah, interesting. Now, David, was the interpretation that, you know, this Midrash is doing on that Jacob was sorely afraid? I mean, there's some kind of language of like dreadful, this is a dreadful place or something in the Genesis accounts. Does it really mean, like fear and dread always just means solemnity sometimes to me rather than like I'm really scared?
Yeah, we could render it with the English term, how awesome place, perhaps something along those lines. I mean, but at the same time, there is something innately frightening about entering the divine presence from an ancient Near Eastern perspective. I think of Isaiah and his prophetic call narrative in chapter 6, where he responds, "Woe is me, I am undone, mine eyes have seen the Lord of hosts." Or even, angels, when they appear, even in the New Testament, the first thing they have to say to the shepherds is, "Do not be afraid," right?
And right.
"You great tidings of joy." There's just something incredibly awesome and powerful about entering into the divine presence that is incredibly frightening, especially with traditions, especially with the traditions regarding those who are not worthy and who are consumed or died in the divine presence, or died. Let me say that again, died. Especially when we consider the ancient Near Eastern traditions that appear even in the Hebrew Bible, where people die when they are not worthy as they enter into the divine presence.
Yeah, yeah. And so whereas the Midrash that Brian is talking about, they're really thinking he's scared. Is he scared for the future there, Brian? Is that what the point was?
No.
Or
no,
it's
not
just,
so much.
It's just the awesomeness of it again. Just,
yeah, just the awesomeness.
So but why would that be a fault that they're trying to protect him from?
Yeah, that's a good question. They want Jacob to be, like I said, this righteous person. And remember, he's had, there's some questionable things in there about the pot, the selling birthright and those kinds of things. So they're just trying to build up this case of the righteousness of Jacob. Now, there's one other point here, if I can just say quickly. In verse 12 of chapter 28, where you have angels of God ascending and descending on it. Now, the early interpreters were wondering, why wouldn't it say going down and then up? because aren't they up there first and then going down? You see, the angels, why are they ascending? Are they already down and then going up? Hmm. And so they were thinking that maybe these angels were already down there accompanying Jacob from his father's house.
Nice.
And so they're, you know, they were really thinkers. You know, they really tried to think through these verses.
Paid attention to every darn word. And stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Brian, is it also possible, and correct me if I'm wrong, would the number 70 in the first Midrash you mentioned have anything to do with the righteousness impacting all of the known nations at the time?
That's a good question, and I'm not really sure how to answer that, Father Tom. I don't really have any information from the Midrash itself on that point. So I guess I would be guessing.
So 70 okay. was the number of known nations, is that what you're saying?
Number of Gentile nations outside the covenant.
Right.
Oh,
okay.
Right. I know where you're going with that, Father Tom, but I don't see anything to kind of help the point.
Okay. Cool. Well, maybe we'll find it one of these days.
Yes.
Cool. Well, David, before we leave 28, I had one more thing again from my, you know, I'm such a scholar. We're eating Spicer, my only source, you know, but he talked about how 28 is a good example of alternating between the J narrative and the P narrative. And some of the what looks like redundancy, if you were to read them separately, it's perfectly well told. Do you want to point any of that stuff out?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And Spicer, when it comes to source identification and translation, is an outstanding source. So I know don't be ashamed of that at all. It's a wonderful resource. Again, that's for our audience's sake. That's the commentary that is a little bit dated. I can't remember the original publication off the top of my head. A year for that, but it's
a lot of them were 1966 and 67.
Wow,
that's 664 is actually the version I've got here.
Is it really? Okay, that early.
Yeah, so they're thank you. They are, but so they're a bit dated in some respects. But this is the Anchor Bible Commentary, and its translation efforts and its source criticism is really, really well done. So, you know, in chapter 28, 10, verses 10 through 22, this passage really is a combination of J and E, and it's a continuation of chapter 27, verse 45, and it records Jacob's first direct encounter with God, and it does appear in these two sources. Remember, the J is going to use Yahweh. And in the E source, that's going to have emphasis upon Elohim, or God, as a translation narrative. And even the Beth-El reference, remember, that's going to be an important site for the Northern Kingdom. And the E source was probably produced in the northern region of Israel, as opposed to the Southern Kingdom of Judah. And so we're going to see that, you know, it just makes sense that given the importance of Beth-El in Israelite worship as a counter to the Jerusalem temple, that this emphasis on the establishment of Beth-El as a temple or cultic location works well with the E tradition. So indeed, we do have two narratives that are redundant and, you know, clearly need to be separated from one another.
Yeah, and he actually, now that I'm looking at it more quickly, he is putting P as the source for, what does it look like, 45 and 46, because he uses El Shaddai.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, you know, he basically talks about how P and J are both the ones that are also the most worried about the purity of the lineage.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. There's definitely some sources that need to be disentangled if we're going to really understand this chapter, without question. Before we move on, I'll pick up on a comment that Brian made about the descending and ascending.
Please.
In Jewish Midrash, of course, they're dealing with this from a later perspective where God dwells up on high with his heavenly court. But in the ancient Near East, and at the time that these biblical sources were put together, as we discussed in the previous podcast, God, Yahweh, is the God of heaven and earth, which are the two realms that are occupied by his divine council of heavenly beings. And though translated as angels in the King James Version, these are not angels from later Western tradition. These are members of the heavenly host that have specific areas of influence where they're governing and watching over some of them in the heavenly realm and some of them on earth. So from an ancient Near Eastern perspective, it makes perfect sense for angels to be both ascending and descending. These are members of the divine council that occupy the realm of heaven and earth. So a different theological view in the Bible than what we see in later from later Jewish Midrash.
Very cool.
And could we also add here that even the priest in Egypt and the high priest of Israel also have this ascending, descending, you know, an ascension motif that every year would come around, you know, in the fall harvest and would actually atone for the people's sins. And, for example, in the 22 endowment rites, you know, in Egypt, there would be a priest who would stand behind the lectern and pull on the string, you know, and they go, caw, 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 you know, and it would, and you'd put on the king, you know, a crown of thorns and a garment, and they would, you know, ascend, you know, into the abyss to be reborn at the end of the enthronement cycle to be a righteous king all over again. And they were copying the moves and taking on the powers of the divine council.
Now that's fascinating.
Crazy amount of stuff in all this, isn't there?
Yeah. And the temple imagery continues in LDS thought now that my mind thinks back upon the way that LDS commentators have added their own spin on it, just as Brian has pointed out, some of the Jewish Midrash commentary that is added on to beyond what the original authors in the plural intended by these accounts. For example, there's a famous statement from Marion G. Romney where he explains why this vision of heaven included a ladder. And from his perspective, here's what he had to say. Quote, when Jacob traveled from Beersheba toward Haran, he had a dream in which he saw himself on the earth at the foot of a ladder that reached to heaven where the Lord stood above it. He beheld angels ascending and descending thereon, and Jacob realized that the covenants he made with the Lord there, remember that's an allusion to the fact that it's called the house of God, were the rungs on the ladder that he himself would have to climb in order to obtain the promised blessings, blessings that would entitle him to enter and associate with the Lord.
Yeah. How many times have we seen bad or very basic lessons where they do steps? Baptism, gift of the Holy Ghost, you know, and they're rungs of usually a staircase, but yeah, the ladder or the staircase. Oh, man.
But here he's going with those specifically as LDS temple covenants. It's a person keeps each of those covenants, allows the individual to ascend and enter near and near to God, as the hymn states.
Interesting. Well, cool. Well, thanks for Jacob's ladder, Jacob's staircase to the temple, whatever it would be. That's a great one. So should we go on and get Jacob and Rachel together?
Sure. So then chapter 29 there's one more thing I wanted to share.
Okay.
All right. There's another beautiful statement as I was thinking about what we might talk about today in this presentation that comes from Yair Zakovich, the Israeli scholar whose work has just been translated into English, Jacob, Unexpected Patriarch. It came out about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. And I think maybe, Dan, if I could share that, it's a nice way to transition into this next pericope. So here's what he in the middle of nowhere, as a day of vigorous walking draws to a close, Jacob decides to pause before continuing his journey. He came upon a place and stopped there for the night, for the sun had set. This shepherd, accustomed to wandering after his flocks, is a homebody, a tent dweller, and not a man of the outdoors. Alone in the backcountry, as the dark night cast its all-encompassing shadow, without his flock or sheepdogs to ease the loneliness, Jacob must suddenly have become singularly aware of his solitary predicament. He seems to have found little to comfort himself, taking one of the stones of that place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place. Can it be, in his rush, that he hadn't stopped to gather even a single piece of clothing or blanket? He has brought nothing with which to cover himself or to put under his head, and he uses a rock as a pillow, an apt illustration of his lonely circumstances. Our hero lies on the cold, hard ground, gazing upward at the stars. It's late. He closes his eyes, and he dreamed. Night closes around the sleeping Jacob, but in his dream, the stage is lit, earth and heaven both illuminated. It begins like a silent film that is gradually revealed in three stages, each opening with the words, "And behold." And behold, a stairway was set on the ground, and its head reached to the sky. And I love this because, you know, in his sensitivity to the reading, Zakovich makes note of the fact that Jacob is alone and he's not used to this sort of lifestyle, which is emphasized in the text by the stone for the pillow. He is lonely. He's looking for, he's lost his family, and he's not used to this rugged lifestyle that he's experiencing. And so the challenge is, you know, if we think about, you know, the idea of the heroic tale that is told over and over again in ancient and even modern stories of the hero who must go through the challenges before becoming and developing qualities, right? The hero of a thousand faces. And sure. And that's really what's happening here, the loneliness. And I just think it's beautiful the way that Yakovich illustrates this and prepares us then for, well, ultimately the blessings that are going to unfold in Jacob's life.
Well, that is beautiful. I have to agree with that. I had never imagined him traveling alone. I certainly didn't travel in haste to where he wouldn't have brought a pillow, you know, kind of thing. I guess I just assumed this was one of those things where, you know, his parents are sending him off to go find a wife, that he would have brought at least some people and some things. I mean, that was just an assumption I had.
Yeah, no, I think because he also has to escape from his brother's fury, remember? So one of the reasons is not only to get a wife.
Oh, got to hurry, yeah.
Yeah, he's got to get out of there because they're afraid that Esau is so upset that he may kill his brother.
Yeah, and it makes sense that, you know, because he could have brought a whole bunch of riches with him and actually kind of bought Rachel instead of having to work for her. So maybe it does make more sense that when we do get to that part of the story that I've got nothing here to offer except who I am.
Exactly, which is why he's going to have to be from a Near Eastern perspective, an indentured servant to Laban, his future father-in-law.
All right, cool.
Even though he promises in verse 21 that he's going to give a tenth unto God, even though he doesn't have anything at this point.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. In fact, yeah, that pledge of the tithe in verse 21, 22, it noticed that it's happening at Bethel, the northern location of worship for the Israelites, and it thus seems to function as a counterpoint to Abraham, who gives a tithe at Salem, which is Jerusalem and the cultic center for Judah, back in Genesis 14, verse 20. So again, here's Bethel being propped up as this temple location, which is where, you know, which is what it serves as for the northern kingdom.
And you did not approach royalty or a person in the Mideastern economy, you know, especially if you wanted a wife, without, bringing some type of payment. Whether it be from the spoils of war, you know, to Melchizedek, or to, a person's future father-in-law. you better bring some money with you.
Nice. All right. Good. Now to the well?
Yeah, I think it's a good segue then into chapter 29, which is remarkably similar to the narrative that we had back in Genesis 24 when Abraham's servant finds a wife for Isaac. Jacob goes to the same area, to Haran, and the same family, and then ultimately what happens is he finds Laban's daughter Rachel and begins the negotiations to marry her. But unlike that previous occasion with Isaac and the servant, this time things are not going to go quite smoothly for Jacob. And he's set up as the trickster who tricked his father, tricked his brother, and now that trickery is going to come around and,
right,
and hit him as well in his own life.
Karma, baby.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, before we get to that negotiation, there's this whole scene at the well that at least I'm kind of interested in. This, we got to wait till they roll away the stone and Jacob goes all He-Man on him and does it himself to impress her.
He does go all He-Man. That's a great comment. It seems that the implications that are there in verse 3, so when all the flocks were gathered there, the stone would be rolled from the mouth of the well and sheep watered, then the stone would be put back in its place on the mouth of the well. So really the implication is that it would take a collective strength at the end of the day for all the shepherds working together to roll that rock off of the well. And, I don't know if Jacob is, energized by the sight of his cousin or wanting to show off his strength, but it does show how powerful this man is, which then does prepare us for his wrestling match where he actually succeeds in struggling in a wrestling match with God himself.
Right, right. Now, and he knows that it's his cousin coming, because the other shepherds have told him that, and then it seems like he wants to impress her. Then it talks about him kissing her right then. Now, we're not going to imagine this as like a romantic kiss. This is more like the kiss of relatives greeting.
Yes, I would think it would be taken in that direction. Although we are going to have really one of the few references to romantic love in the book of Genesis in this particular chapter, where Jacob is going to fall in love with his cousin. And usually when the Hebrew Bible uses the term love, it does not denote the romantic love that we think of in a contemporary Western sense. Marriage in the ancient, or even in the Middle Ages, was really based upon, status movement and establishing, who receives what rights and privileges, both men, women, and children as well. So to have this allusion here to romantic love that's about to befall us is somewhat unusual from a biblical perspective, even.
Wasn't it also true in the Hebrew mentality that love is something that came over time, but it wasn't based on love as our modern Western concepts of romanticism were? So when it says he loved her, like Jacob, loved his wife, or Abraham loved Sarah, that's sort of an addition there that we just tend to read right over, isn't it? Because it wasn't necessary. Some kings married into their Egyptian counterparts, for political gain, or you got land, or you got wealth, or royal status. That was oftentimes a reason for marriage, where Rachel steals, the gods from her household and things like that. These things were all tied to status, even from a standpoint of worship.
That's well said. And love has covenantal significance all throughout the Hebrew Bible. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, might, and strength. It's not an emotional attachment as much as covenantal devotion, in the same type of relationship that a vassal would have to a suzerain or a higher king. So that's typically the way that love is used. And yet here you do have in verse 18, even before he has really gotten to know her, a reference to, Jacob loved Rachel. So he answered, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Now we're jumping ahead in the narrative, but still that is really one of the very few references, explicit references, to this concept of romantic love in the entire Pentateuch.
Awesome. All right, so she runs and tells Dad what's going on. He welcomes them in, and they start negotiating for her hand, and he tells her about Leah. So pick up the Leah business here.
Yeah, and I'll just, before we do that, let me also state that I really think that going back to his
heroism of unrolling that stone away at the well at the time that he meets this bride-to-be. Boy, doesn't that sound familiar from a biblical perspective, right? That seems to foreshadow perhaps Moses' scene of the daughters of Reuel in Exodus chapter 2. So you got a lot going on there in terms of, you know, things, narratives, type scenes that are played and replayed and rehashed all throughout the Hebrew Bible over and over again. Picking it up then, yeah, he's going to negotiate back and forth, and it's interesting. Well, we'll pick it up in verse 15. Laban said to Jacob, "Just because you are a kinsman, should you serve me for nothing?" He doesn't have anything, right? "Tell me, what shall your wages be?" Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes. Rachel was shapely and beautiful, and Jacob loved Rachel. So he answered, "I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban said, "Better that I give her to you than I should give her to an outsider. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and then you've got this beautiful verse, "They seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her." And then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my time is fulfilled, that I may cohabit with her." And Laban gathered all the people of the place and made a feast. When evening came, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and he cohabited with her, not the sister that he had worked for.
Right.
And Laban had given his maidservant, Zilpah, to his daughter Leah as her maid. When the morning came, there was Leah, right? There she is. So he said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. Why did you deceive me?" A play upon his name, Jacob, which means trickster or a deceiver. And it's interesting, and I've heard some LDS commentators try to explain this in various ways. They don't want Jacob to have been drunk at this occasion, and they'll talk about non-alcoholic wine, and talk about customs of having,
not linguistically provable.
Tom's exactly right. It's not linguistically viable, and also the concept of a non-drunken patriarch not only is problematic here, but in stories like Noah and other pericopes in the Hebrew Bible. We've discussed this in previous podcasts, but we should understand this as a festival occasion where he is drunk, he is unaware of exactly what's going on, and ultimately Laban is able to deceive him and give him the older sister.
Yeah. So we got the drunken thing. Would it also be pretty uncommon for you to have relations with the lights on? Typically, how there's that kind of stuff, to bring a modern view to it, that you could actually have sex with somebody and not do a lot of talking and really not know.
I don't know what to do with
it. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you're talking Midrash there, because that's exactly what the Midrash comes up.
Oh, okay.
He was drunk and it was dark.
Okay. And it wasn't a sin to be drunk.
Peter said, even suggested that Leah had eyes like a cow because of her name. Shmi Leah. My name's Leah. And is there any truth to that?
Well, the Midrash doesn't go at it from that angle. It has that Leah's eyes are weak, bleary eyes because she has been weeping so much over the fact
that she's not married.
Well, over the fact that she was supposed to marry Esau.
Oh,
and she's
like
upset about that. She doesn't want to marry Esau, and so she wept until her eyelashes fell out.
Oh wow. So in other words, we're here, we kind of almost like the two families have separated for a long time, and this assumes that they knew of each other and they knew that there were two brothers of Rebecca.
Yes.
Okay, two sons of Rebecca.
Yes.
Wow.
There's also some more Midrash that says that Leah was complicit. Here's one from Genesis Rabbah. "All that night he, Jacob, kept calling her Rachel, and she kept answering him, 'Yes.' But the next morning, behold, it was Leah. He said to her, 'Liar and daughter of a liar.' She answered, can there be a schoolmaster without any pupils? Was it not just this way that your father called out to you, Esau, and you answered him? So when you call me, like I likewise answered you.
Yeah, interesting.
I've never seen that before.
Turn the tables, buddy. You can't complain when I do it.
That's right.
Well, and obviously she had to be complicit in some ways. But David, maybe you can help us, or even Tom, or any of you guys. How much under control of your father are you? In other words, you know, is she complicit, or does she really have zero choice in the matter but to do exactly as her dad commanded her?
Laban has a lot of power, I think, in this whole thing here. And, of course, the Midrash people don't like him at all. They call him a cheat and a scoundrel. So, but his idea is he wants to marry her off because she's the one that's less likely to get married.
That's the way I've read it.
Yeah, and I really don't think in this strong patriarchal environment that, she has much say. If we think about some of the biblical legal practices about a rape, for instance, of an unmarried daughter, she is married off, according to later biblical laws, to the rapist, and
right.
then the rapist has to pay the bride price to the father. So you're dealing
with a very
strong patriarchal environment where we wouldn't assume that she would really have much say whatsoever in this circumstance.
Well, Leah's sure a sympathetic character, at least in my mind, because, you know, to know that you're not the loved one, to have to do this, and then, you know, you just see the pathos every time she bears a son to him about maybe now he'll love me because I did this and I did this. Oh, what a terrible, horrible, you know, lot for her in some ways.
And also, you weren't a full-fledged woman unless you had children. Like, you weren't a man, as the Mishnah says, if you weren't married. And so there's some female status there she's trying to acquire.
Yes, definitely. To return then to what Brian had said earlier on the Midrash that picks up on the relationship between the deception here and what Jacob participated in with Isaac. You know, Laban's response in verse 26 is quite telling. Laban said, "It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the elder," right, in this verse 26. And so, you know, this seems to be almost an ironic reaffirmation of this idea of the principle that Jacob, the younger of the siblings, had violated in buying Esau's birthright and defrauding him of his father's highest blessing back in Genesis chapter 27. So having acquired his older brother's birthright for a mere bowl of lentils, he now proves that he is unable to acquire the woman that he loves, even after 7 years of harsh labor. So it really is, you use, Dan, the term karma, what comes around goes around. This seems to be a principle that the narrative wants to bring out.
Very cool, very cool. And do you think Laban is lying when he says this is such a hard and fast law that you got to marry the first one over the older before the younger, or is it just, do you know anything about the customs of that day? Was it really such a bad thing? And if so, why wouldn't they have known this ahead of time and it wouldn't have had to have the deception?
Yeah, how in their particular custom, whether how this was a hard, fast rule, it's difficult to say, but I think we can take the text seriously when Laban says it's just not the way we do things. It wasn't, because remember, marriages were not based upon romance or love.
Yeah.
They were based upon these political alliances and establishing place within the community. And so that's what makes this story so beautiful, and that it talks about romantic love and its devotion, notwithstanding, you know, some of the challenges that we face in terms of Leah and the way that she is treated by Jacob, you said, Dan, she's very sympathetic. I think she's not only sympathetic to us as readers, but she's sympathetic to the Lord, right? So that's why we have in verse 31, the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren.
Right.
So it really is, we're reminded of this in Genesis, of the story of Hagar, remember, because God is this type of deity who does show compassion to the unfavored and to the unloved. He's the one who will intervene and try to equalize this position by making the unloved spouse fertile.
Yep.
Scholars such as Plant actually say there was a Canaanite marriage pecking order that was being followed here in the local economy. I wondered if anybody has any thoughts on that. Then he adds where the love and where God equalizing the relationships, you know, come in is where the Hebrew Bible tries to transcend some of the Near Eastern mythology. I wonder if anybody would have any thoughts on that.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It's always difficult to jump in and recognize when the account is trying to produce a polemic against other types of Near Eastern traditions and myths. The polemicy certainly happens in the Hebrew Bible, but it's very difficult to say for sure when those cases are, when they're not explicitly laid out.
Yeah.
Excellent point.
So the deed is done. He marries Leah. I guess he has to wait out a week, and then Laban knows he now has another 7 years of labor. And so at the end of that, well, go ahead and talk about, I guess, what happens next as some children start to get being born.
Yeah, so we see that really in verses 32 through 35, because the Lord intervenes and on the part of Leah. He gives her the first three sons, and she names them in a way that communicates the deep distress that she feels for not being the preferred wife, despite the fact that she is the oldest daughter. So each of these sons' names, Reuben, for example, seems and Simeon and so forth, they all have some sort of, you know, Hebrew wordplay on the idea of that is laid out in the text of the fact that the Lord has seen and helped me with my affliction, and now my husband will love me, she states, and all of this is based upon Hebrew folk etymologies for these ancient patriarchal figures.
Right, good. And it says that at the end of 35 that she leaves her childbearing after Judah. We know that's not true because later she conceives again.
Yeah.
So interesting. Anyway, do you know, is that just because it's a different tradition? Is that a J versus E or anything like that? Or
yeah, it might be because there are some inconsistencies.
Yeah,
it's difficult to lay out some of this some of this material, and you know, scholars.
Some of the fundamentalists just say it was a divine miracle, and the original will was thwarted. I don't think we can go there.
Yeah.
Okay, so after these four children, we go along, and Rachel's like, man, why am I not doing this? I need some children, too. It looks like it's not going to happen with me. Bilhah, you're my handmaid. Jacob, here she is. Go for it. I want babies from her.
Exactly, which is another allusion back to the Abraham tradition, right? Because we have
Hagar.
Mm-hmm, with Hagar. So it seems to be this ancient Near Eastern practice of placing a child on one's knees to represent the idea that the child belongs to that person, an adoption of some sort, ritual. And it is. It's really the words that through her I too may have children is a direct allusion to the story of Hagar, which is back in chapter 16, verse 2. At that point, then, continuing forward, we have this interesting reference to the mandrakes. Perhaps we should
the aphrodisiacs.
Exactly. So, verse 14, we'll pick it up there. Once at the time of the wheat harvest, Reuben came upon some mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Now, this mandrake is a plant. It's purplish. It's got this purplish flowers, and it does seem to have, you said it, Dan, correctly, aphrodisiac properties or qualities. We'll see it alluded to in the Song of Songs, like in chapter 7. I don't remember which verse off the top of my head, but it's alluded to there to have those qualities. So he finds them, he gives them to Leah. And this is obviously, he recognizes that his mother is not having sexual relations with his father. And so this is hopefully going to help. Now, Rachel will then find out about this, and she says to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But Leah responds to her and says, was it not enough for you to take away my husband, that you would also take my son's mandrakes? Rachel then replies, I promise he shall lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes. And when Jacob came home from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you are to sleep with me, for I have hired you with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night. And here, you know, it really does pull on your heartstrings, this poor girl, right? I mean, it's just so tragic that she has to literally buy her
a night. I want to turn.
Yeah, a night with her husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, and again, is that just because he just would naturally always go to Rachel just because that's who he prefers? But again, I guess I'm confused because of the aphrodisiac qualities here of this. Is Rachel also saying, I need a little spice in the bedroom? What the heck is, like, why is it so desirable that, I mean, you know, if she's already got the guy.
There was a pecking order.
Yeah. Yeah, and your question, Dan, is one that we ultimately can't answer because the text doesn't tell us what Rachel did
with
the mandrakes. I mean, are they supposed to help her become pregnant?
Yeah, maybe
we don't
that's
know
what she's thinking.
Because, yeah, we'd expect them to play a role in helping her to overcome her infertility, but the account wants to make clear that, nope, it's not the mandrakes, it's God alone. Yeah. That's going to make that happen. In verse 22, God remembered Rachel. God heeded her and opened her womb. So, you know, it's a question, Dan, that you're based upon your sensitivity to reading the text that we ultimately can't answer.
Well, definitely an interesting stuff here. So the rest of 30, we're going back and forth with give me, you know, have some kids and whatnot. Finally, we get Dinah in verse 21. Finally, then, 22, we get Rachel. She gets the son Joseph. And now it's time that Jacob wants to leave. He wants to take both of his families and go. So pick us up there.
Okay. So then we move on from the, you know, sexual politics to chapter 30, verses 25. Through 43, the end of chapter 30, where Jacob is going to grow very, very wealthy. And we have more trickery on the part of his father-in-law, and ultimately Jacob is going to be able to overcome that through some interesting practices. Yeah, where do you want me to go?
Well, again, so it's time I want to leave, and he's going, what on earth? You're leaving me here? And how does he talk him into another 6 years? It has to do with flocks and, you know, I've gotten rich while you were here. Now you're going to leave me. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't quite understand it. So help us. What's Laban's bargaining chip at this point?
Okay, so verse 25, Rachel had born Joseph, and then Jacob said to Laban, give me leave to go back to my own homeland. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, that I may go. For well you know what services I have rendered you. But Laban said unto him, if you will indulge me, I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me on your account. So he does recognize that, you know, Jacob, that God is with Jacob because he's the heir of the Abrahamic promises, and therefore whoever associates with him in the same way that Joseph will later, remember, produce blessings for the house of Potiphar, that Jacob has that same sort of ability because of his relationship with Yahweh.
Okay.
Laban recognizes it, right? And he continues, and he said, name the wages due from me, and I will pay you. So, remarkable statement. But he said, you know well how I have served you and how your livestock has fared with me. So, verse 30, for the little you had before I came has grown to much since the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. And now, when shall I make provision for my own household? And, you know, this is a great little section here, and it really illustrates that Jacob has accepted the status of an indentured servant. So as an indentured servant, he cannot leave without his master's permission.
Got it.
And his wives and children. Remember, at least his wives and children, according to the covenant collection in Exodus chapter 21, they would belong to the master. So, we've talked about this before. To what extent can we apply those later legal traditions to patriarchal narratives is difficult to answer, but still it does show that that's kind of the working assumption in the land, that the wives and children would belong to the master, and they can't go out with him.
Okay, so he really does need permission, and that's when Laban decides to start making his terms. Okay, he knows he ultimately can't stop him. You said something earlier about Laban says, by divination I've learned this. I didn't pick that up in the text. Was that a misspeak? Or
No, I was reading, actually, I switched over. I didn't mention, I should have said that I jumped over to the Jewish Publication Society translation, the JPS, a little bit easier, I think, to read the King James in this section.
Okay. And so somehow or other, Laban, in verse 27, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for thy sake. Is it something like I've learned by divination? Or I've learned through revelation or something? Is that what?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. A little bit more in the mystical sense.
Or I'm going to throw a layer of God on you here to help guilt you into taking my terms.
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay, so now we get this whole business of, okay, yeah, you've gotten richer here. How are we going to divide up here? And talk about the speckled and spotted and ring-straked animals versus the others.
Yeah, it's very confusing to a modern reader, without question. But so we'll pick it up then, and he's in verse 31, he said, what shall I pay you? And Jacob says, pay me nothing. If you will do this thing for me, I will again pasture and keep your flocks. Let me pass through your whole flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted animal, every dark-colored sheep, and every spotted and speckled goat. Such shall be my wages. So I'll go ahead and I'll take all of those animals that have speckles and spots and things, and you'll get the standard colored ones.
So these are pretty much exceptions to the rule. There are not going to be as many of them.
Yeah, exactly. Because, what ultimately he's going to do then, well, let me say it this way, that, yeah, the goats were ordinarily in the ancient Near East very dark. And so he's really saying that I will take just a few of the animals from the herd, those that have these spots and other types of markings. So because most of the goats are going to be very, very dark, right? So that's the idea behind it. And that's why Laban, verse 34, said, very well, let it be as you say. You know, it's a good deal for him.
Right.
But verse 35, that same day, he removed the streaked and spotted he-goats and all the speckled and spotted she-goats, every one that had white on it, and all the dark-colored sheep, and left them in the charge of his son. So he goes through and he does this.
He sneaks them out without Jacob being able to go and get them for himself. He removes them all, so there's none for Jacob.
Another example of trickery and deception in the life of Jacob. So verse 36, he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob while Jacob was pasturing the rest of Laban's flock. But Jacob then, he is going to know what has happened. It's not really clear how, but whether he knows what has happened or whether he's just going to then result to trickery himself. It's a little bit unclear in the account. But verse 37, Jacob is going to go get fresh shoots of poplar and of almond and plain and peeled white stripes in them, laying bare the white of the shoots. So he's getting these branches and shoots from a tree and pulling some of the bark away so that there are white stripes in them. That's what he's doing. And the rods, verse 38, that he had peeled, he set up in front of the goats in the troughs, the water receptacles, and the goats came to drink from. And their mating occurred when they came to drink. Interesting that, of course, you know, not, here you have them at the wells, right, and they're going to Again,
meet up.
meet up at the well. Even the animals are enticed into sexual relationships there. And since the goats mated by the rods, next to these rods where he's pulled off the bark so that you can see the white streaks in them, the goats brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted young.
Nice.
So it really is based upon this ancient Near Eastern tradition that a folklore that whatever animals see as they're copulating will determine the appearance of the young. You know, if they see white stripes and patches and things like that, then the young are going to come out looking just like that. So this is wonderful. The Bible reflects, I think, these ancient Near Eastern traditions, and Jacob takes matters into his own hands. And I don't know if he did this because he knew what was happening or if he was just trying to increase his numbers through trickery.
Yeah.
Right. Either way,
he's going to use folk magic for his own use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it turns out for his good.
This really shows the how Laban's duplicity in this whole thing and the designs that he has, or the designs of the wicked generally, come to naught, while Jacob, is being focused on here as the good guy, and being watched over and helped. And in the Midrash, it has Jacob being instructed by angels to do all this stuff, to make that white, bark and such towards the facing the sheep and cattle or whatever, and copulating there, and then Jacob actually ends up with more of the flocks than Laban would ever imagine. So
now I don't quite understand the cattle business with the weaker and the stronger cattle that starts with 41. Help me there, David, what his plan is with the stronger and the weaker and putting them in the gutters, conceive among the rods.
Yeah, so 41, we read, moreover, when the sturdier animals were mating, Jacob would place the rods in the troughs in full view of the animals so that they mated by the rods. And that term sturdier, again, from the JPS, the Jewish Publication Society, means early breeding, something like that. So verse 42, but when the feebler animals, meaning in those that were late breeding, that bred later, they went to Laban, and the sturdy to Jacob. So the men grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks, maidservants and men servants, camels and asses. So it's really a question of early versus late breeding when we talk about the strong ones versus the weak ones. And it's a way for Jacob then to distinguish between the two and allow for his own flocks to continue to grow while Laban's now are going to falter.
Okay. And because the later ones aren't going to see the white rods, the branches with the white covering, then go ahead and they're not going to, they're just going to stay brown or whatever their color was then. Yep. Versus,
exactly.
Okay, so it's the same basic principle of whatever they're seeing, they're going to do it. So,
yep.
No, that helps on the stronger and the weaker,
good,
the feebler.
Good.
So now we get the Lord commanding Jacob to return in chapter 31, David.
So chapter 31, God's going to command Jacob to return and go back to Canaan now that he's blessed and has all of this material to start the family of Israel, the covenant family. And so he'll depart in secrecy. And Laban is very upset about this, will pursue him. And there's some interesting exchanges there that take place. And ultimately, the two make a non-aggression pact is ultimately what it is,
right,
and go their separate ways.
Okay. Is there any particularly interesting verses or passages in this whole story?
I think really the maybe that household idols would be.
Yeah, definitely for that. Anything before that? Because that is absolutely the intriguing part. So they sneak away. They know that Laban just kind of knows his attitude. So they definitely sneak away, and then Laban gets everybody and let's go. Find everybody, but I guess maybe we are ready for Rachel sneaking out the household idols.
Yeah. So we can pick it up then in verse 19. Meanwhile, Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household idols. Now, the thing to note is that the narrator is always going to refer to these statues that Rachel steals from her father Laban as household idols. And that is Hebrew. The Hebrew term there is teraphim. These are small little statues that represent gods. And that's the point. Laban, when he refers to these, will refer to them specifically as Elohim, as gods.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a distinction there. Perhaps the narrator doesn't want to refer to these idols as literal gods. And so there, as we move back and forth in the account, we'll notice that distinction being made. So verse 20, Jacob kept Laban, the Armenian, in the dark, not telling him that he was fleeing. And he fled with all that he had. And soon he was across the Euphrates and heading toward the hill country of Gilead. And on the third day, Laban was told that Jacob had fled. So he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days, catching up with him in the hill country of Gilead. But God appeared to Laban, the Armenian, in a dream by night and said to him, "Beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad." So God is going to intervene on the part of this patriarchal figure and give this warning.
Good to know that Laban can hear the voice of God after all of his deceits.
Yeah.
Tom or Brian?
Yeah. Just a little bit again from the Midrash. What they're trying to do is absolve Rachel of any wrongdoing here. Because in Genesis, of course, it says Rachel stole her father's household gods.
Right.
And but in Targum, it says Rachel took her father's idols. So they're trying to soften things a little bit, soften the language, but they still wanted to figure out what would be the motive for Rachel wanting to take those household gods. And in Genesis, Rabbah says, Rachel is saying, "Can we leave this old man," meaning her dad, "in the midst of his idolatry? That is why the scripture found it necessary to say, 'And Rachel stole.'" In other words, we don't want, you know, Laban to keep being idolatrous, so we're just going to take his household gods away. Not that he can't get another one, I guess, but, you know. So since she wished to free her father of idolatry, she took them, the household gods, away. And so, again, trying to absolve Rachel of this wrongdoing,
yeah,
apparent wrongdoing.
Well, that's let's get him out of his idol worship. That's a pretty bold one. But that'd be pretty minority position, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So Laban then gets his men together. They pursue them. He overtakes him. And verse 26, Laban said to Jacob, "What did you mean by keeping me in the dark and carrying off my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee in secrecy and mislead me and not tell me? I would have sent you off with festive music and so forth. You didn't even let me kiss my sons and daughters goodbye. It was a foolish thing for you to do. I have it in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father said to me last night, 'Beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad. Very well, you had to leave because you were longing for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?'" And he uses it as an attempt to, you know, get the gods back. And yeah, interesting.
There was also a complaint in verse 15 that Laban had spent the bridal price.
Yeah. Yes. And it's, you know, I think I don't know if there's sincerity on his part here. I think, you know, there perhaps some sincerity because he's recognized that God is with him and he's given him this warning that he can't do anything about it and he better let this thing take place. But at the same time, he has to, he does want his gods back, these idols that she's stolen from him.
Yeah. And now we get the fun little search for him. He's going into everybody and looking for him. And then we get the lovely little deception by Rachel. Take us through that.
It's very dramatic because Jacob's response is, "Well, whoever has stolen this from you will die." Now, this also is going to sound familiar because this whole thing will be repeated in the Joseph narrative with his brothers, right?
Yep.
And so, these same archetypal themes keep happening over and over again in Genesis. And so Laban, we read in verse 33, went into Jacob's tent, but and Leah's tent, and the tent of the two maidservants, but he did not find them. Leaving Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. And the drama is very intense, and we're frightened. And Rachel, for her, as readers of the account, but Rachel, meanwhile, had taken the idols, placed them in the camel cushion, and sat on them. So remember, the cushion that she would use to ride upon the camel, which are anachronistic probably, as we discussed last time. But still, she sits down on them, and Laban rummaged through the tent without finding him. For she said to her father, "Let not my lord take it amiss that I cannot rise before you, for the period of women is upon me." And thus he searched, but he could not find the household idols. Okay, so here you have this allusion to, you know, cultic menstruation as a sign of impurity that appears later in the book of Leviticus, like in chapter 15, it's discussed at length. So there's this tradition that women are impure and unclean and should not have any contact whatsoever. Even touching a woman would spread impurity, although that's somewhat, from at least a biblical perspective, anachronistic, because the priestly laws of purification have not yet been given.
Oh, yeah,
Moses.
Right. That makes sense. Well, interesting. Now, Spicer makes a lot of this Rachel and the God stuff and has it to be more a strategy on her part, recognizing that because of the indentured servitude that they'd sort of been under, that in a court of law that, Laban might have been able to win and prevail if he really wanted to get them all back. But apparently, at least according to, I don't know whether it's later traditions or whatever, and Spicer's reading back, the fact that if you possess the idols of the house, that does show that, like, perhaps that they were a gift to you and you do have a rightful piece of it. So the fact that she could produce those, if it ever came to that, would have been sort of the trump card, and they would have been able to be let go. Does any of that track with you, David?
It does, yeah. And at the same time, we're left wondering, you know, why does she keep these idols ultimately when it's something that is so disconcerting to later biblical authors? And, well, even in this account, for example, going back to what I pointed out earlier, that the narrator will never call them gods. They're going to be idols. And why does she, this matriarch in Israel, keep these taboo objects? Remember, the biblical authors are going to be very, very concerned that Israelites do not use graven images of any sort. Even the narrator will refuse to call these idols gods, although Laban refers to them as such. So this may be perhaps an oral tradition where they were actually accepted as cultic objects by Jacob and by Rachel. And
there's also supposed to be a Nisai tablet that suggests the rightful heir of the family gods were also an heir of the property and the fortune and the inheritance of the family.
Yeah, which is the Spicer commentary that Dan was referring to. Which is, so you've got these two different possibilities going on here. It is interesting, I think, thematically to link these back to where we began our story back in Genesis chapter 28. In verse 18, back in 28, early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and he set it up as a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. So it's a reference to sacred pillars that serve and take the place of idols, not only in several biblical texts, but in general Canaanite traditions, we'll find in cultic areas and temple shrines standing free pillars that represent the gods of the heavenly council. And so there is some sort of connection here, although it's that type of freestanding pillar is prohibited in texts like Deuteronomy and some of the minor prophets like Micah and Hosea. Even Moses sets up 12 of these freestanding pillars at the foot of Mount Sinai in Exodus 24. And it it helps us recognize that in the ancient Near East, there are different ways of representing God and the deities of the divine council, sometimes through idols and sometimes through pillars, freestanding pillars and stones. And all of these are described, sometimes accepted, sometimes rejected, all throughout the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, so not necessarily taboo. It's just sort of where they were at this time and place in there.
Probably, and who they were given to as far as which cult of worship was using them.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Spicer seems more interesting to me that, you know, as a token of I've released you from indenturedness, he would normally give them some of the household idols as a symbol of that, and the fact that she knew that her dad wouldn't probably do that, so she takes them. That seems cleaner to me, but that's okay. It's up in the air, so that's good. Good to have those recognition of it. Who knows what's going on, really. Okay, now they do make their covenant with each other, Laban and Jacob.
Yeah, and it's basically a covenant of non-aggression, a
right.
pact between the two. They split up and they go their ways, and now we're prepared for, I know, something that Father Tom's been really excited to get to for quite some time, this wrestling match between God and Jacob.
Yeah, me too. So basically, though, the scene is Laban and Jacob build an altar, and then they kind of get everybody around there to witness their thing that I won't go past this place, as I won't pursue you anymore, and you won't come back towards me in my lands either, right?
Yep.
So it's more like a border between us.
Yep. Okay. Yep, exactly.
Okay. And curses fall upon us if it happens.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.